We are studying the book of Genesis. I'm on page 151. This chapter I call Coming to Know God Involves Trial, Error, and Struggle. Genesis 32, verse 1. Now, as Jacob was on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named the place Mahanaim, which means double camp. Jacob has just had an encounter with Laban, his father-in-law, who has chased him down and threatened him, but has shown mercy because God threatened to kill Laban if he didn't. They've sort of patched it up in a way. Laban's acknowledged that even though all the wives are his, flocks are his, and whatever, that God has told him to leave it alone. And so he's let Jacob go away with his wives and his children and his flocks, all of which are legally Laban's, and Laban has accepted that that's God's will that that happen. And so Laban's behind him. And what's ahead of him is Esau. 20 years ago, he tried to trick Esau out of his inheritance. And then he had to flee for his life, and so he ran into the arms of Laban, who treated him far worse than Esau ever would have. And he's managed to extricate himself from Laban, and now he turns to face Esau. Something that he messed up 20 years ago that now he's going to have to fix. And as soon as Laban goes, Jacob is aware that a camp of angels has come around his camp. And so he says, "This place is Mahanaim, a double camp, us and the Lord." And so he has this sense of assurance that God will be with him. The angels build their camp around him in a protective manner. So Jacob names the place Mahanaim, meaning double camp. Jacob is about to need that protection. Esau looms large on the horizon. Jacob's concern and dread of what is coming causes him to seek God. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He commanded them, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and have stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob and said, We came to your brother Esau. Furthermore, he is coming to meet you with 400 men who are with him." That didn't sound good. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided his people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. For he said, "If Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape." Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord who didst say to me, 'Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you,' I am unworthy of all the loving kindness," or word mercy is better for us, "I am unworthy of all the mercy and of all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For thou didst say, 'I will surely prosper you, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" Jacob sues for peace with Esau, asking for his favor. As we go along, we'll see great steps that he takes in this regard. He calls himself your servant to Esau, and he's showing deference to his older brother. He calls Esau my lord, acknowledging his headship of the family. He tells Esau that he lacks for nothing, and he needs nothing that belongs to Esau, which, remember, was what he was trying to steal 20 years ago. Jacob's scouts warn him that Esau is on the march to meet him with an army. For all Esau knows, Jacob might be coming home to claim his inheritance. Jacob divides his camp into two groups in order to save at least half of them. He seeks God with great passion and intensity. He acknowledges his unworthiness. Jacob is becoming sanctified by his trials. He reminds God of God's covenantal promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to himself at Bethel in Genesis 28. Jacob is becoming a man of God. He's becoming a man of God in spite of his corruption, his brokenness, his deceptiveness, all that. All of that he's reaping, all of that he's dealing with. And he finds himself in a situation where if he does not rely on God, he has nothing to hope for.
Wayne,
yeah.
Would Isaac want retribution for being, for having the wool pulled over his eyes? Is Isaac still alive?
He is. He is. Isaac is still alive.
Okay. Would he tell Esau to seek retribution for?
He would not.
So what's done is done.
No, well, Isaac, first of all, when you talk about Isaac, you're talking about a man who's relatively peaceful. He's a peacenik. Isaac is a kind of a live and let live guy. But even if he hadn't been, if he had been a more aggressive person, the theft was against Esau, not against Isaac.
But he fooled Isaac.
The deception against Isaac, Isaac's long forgiven him for. But and Isaac is, as it happens, a very meek man.
So he didn't ask Esau to go after Jacob?
Oh, no. No, the last thing he wants to do is to lose a son, either one of them. And the fact that Jacob would be coming home would actually be a blessing to him. But remember when Jacob left, I mean, the last thing he knew, the last thing Esau knew was, is Jacob had conjured up a legal trick to steal his blessing and his birthright. And although he had fled at that particular point in time, theoretically he'd gone away for a few weeks, but he's been gone for 20 years. He's now coming back with a huge household of men, servants, women, I mean, all kinds of stuff. And as far as he knows, he's coming back to collect his inheritance, as far as Esau knows. The truth of the matter is that Esau is not angry either. He's just not going to let him take his stuff away. We'll see. Okay. So Jacob's fear is really based in the fact that he knows he's wrong more than anything else. And, you know, Esau's coming with an army of men. That sounds bad. Yeah. But Esau's more about protecting what he has than anything else. And we'll see. Esau's eventually going to ask Jacob to move and live among him. We'll see this. Esau's not upset. But Jacob's afraid he is. And he knows he deserves for him to be. Huh?
Coming with an army.
Yeah, well, he's coming with a load of men. Jacob assumes it's for war.
Yeah.
I think Esau is not going to let Jacob take anything from him. But beyond that, I think it is for protection. But we'll get there. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on before me and put a space between the droves." And he commanded the one in the front, saying, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do these belong? Where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong?' then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. Behold, he is also behind us.'" Then he commanded also the second and the third and those who are following, saying, "After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. You shall say, 'Behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us.' For he said, 'I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face, and perhaps he will accept me.' And the present passed on before him, and he himself spent the night in the camp." So he takes a great horde of animals and sends them in droves, one after another, to meet Esau and to say, "This is a present from your brother Jacob to his lord Esau." So he's positioning himself as subservient to Esau. And also, instead of saying, "I've come to take your stuff," he's saying, I'm giving you stuff. So he prepares a series of rolling offerings for Esau, whose acceptance he now seeks. Having run away from Esau, he actually wound up under the thumb of a harsher Laban. He now finds himself passionately seeking to undo his evil deed of 20 years earlier. All of his prior conniving was at great cost to himself, and he never actually gains what he tried to steal from Esau 20 years earlier. Never gets it. At this point, he no longer even wants it. Instead, he wants peace with his brother. Rebekah fails to get what she wanted either. She loses access to her favorite son for 20 years. She sends him into a harsher environment than he would have if he'd stayed home under Esau, and she never sees him again in her lifetime because she dies while he's gone. Esau, who cared not a fig for spiritual things, would have left that field entirely to Jacob anyway, the spiritual world. All their scheming is for naught. Now he rose in the same night, and he took his two wives and his two maids, his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok, and he took them and he sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. So having sent everything out ahead of him, he takes his wives and his concubines and his children and goes back across the Jabbok to position himself with a river between him and Esau. We'll get to more about this in just a minute. And so he is then alone in the camp by himself. And a man came and wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he, that's the man, who is God, saw that he, God, had not prevailed against Jacob, he touched the socket of his thigh so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. So this is a funny story. God is wrestling with Jacob, and he's wrestling with Jacob and limiting himself to what Jacob can wrestle with. So he and Jacob are wrestling, and he's not prevailing over Jacob all night long. He's not prevailing over Jacob. God can obviously wipe him out in half just with a thought. But what he does is he positions himself to us as one of us, limits himself so that we can relate to him. I'll give you an example. Your child comes to you and says, if you do this, I will hate you, I will never see you again, or whatever, and starts to bang, you know, whatever on you. Okay, so what you do is you rear back, you take your fist, you knock her teeth out, splatter across the floor, right? No. Okay, what you do is you limit yourself so that you don't hurt this child. I mean, you maybe restrain them and whatever, but you limit yourself. Does that make sense? Well, this is what God's doing. Jacob, this man's coming to the tent, and Jacob is in a mood to, he's wrestling with everything. He's wrestling with all he's done. He's wrestling with what's coming. And so this man comes to the tent, and Jacob tackles him. And the two of them fight all night long, and the man is God. We'll get to that in a minute. So God limits himself, and he wrestles with Jacob. So then God said, let me go, for dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. And he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been preserved. Jacob knows he has wrestled with God. When he says, what is your name? He said, why are you asking me my name? You know who I am. Now the sun rose upon him just as he pressed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. So he's wrestling with Jacob. Jacob won't let him go, and so he reaches down and puts his hip out of joint. Hip out of joint. And for the rest of his life, Jacob limps on that broken hip. Jacob is in his camp alone. He wrestles all night with God. Don't we ourselves often wrestle with God? You have to think about this. Jacob's been wrestling with God, with both man and God, all of his life. He is, after all, the supplanter. His great strength, rolling the wellstone, his revealed insight and his devious nature have caused him to prevail until now. Jacob cannot, however, defeat God. He comes away limping from the encounter. Now, I have wrestled with God on numerous occasions. about this or that, something I'm unhappy about, something I don't like, something I want, whatever. Wrestle with God, wrestle with God, wrestle with God. And what happens is whenever we wrestle with God, we always come away limping because we cannot defeat God. It's not until we submit to His purposes that we can be at peace with Him. We can wrestle and wrestle all we want. I've seen people angry at God much of their life, not all their life, just shaking their fists the whole nine yards. Gets them nowhere. Gets them nowhere. I wanted to be a pastor with all my heart. Some of y'all heard part of the story. I'm not going to get into it. It's too long. But I tried everything in my will to be a pastor. I even went to seminary in my 50s so I could be a pastor. I was full-time pastor for 5 years. And I wanted to do it for my whole life. God granted it for 5 years and said, that's enough. Now I want you to do what I want you to do. And when I, seriously, when I came out of seminary, I went up to Flowery Branch and tried to start two churches. Failed miserably. Kept trying to do this. Finally, God gave me a church. Because He'll do that. If you keep pushing Him, He'll give you what you want. It was the most horrible experience I've ever had in my life. Nancy will tell you. It was just horrible. Just take my word for it. It was horrible. And it was what they, you know, talk about cure you of sucking eggs. If you have a dog that's in the hen house and you want to make him stop, give him a rotten egg and he'll quit going to the hen house. Well, God gave me a rotten egg. It was horrible. And I finally said, God, if you get me out of this, I will never again try to be a full-time pastor. And He was gracious and He got me out of it. Graciously got me out of it. And it was kind of like, I don't ever want to go there again. I wanted what I wanted. I was sure I wanted what I wanted. I was sure I wanted to be this whatever. And tried so many different ways to get there. And wrestled with God and came away limping. Now that's just one thing. I mean, I've wrestled with God over lots of things over the years. My will versus His will. What I want versus what He wanted, etc., etc. And the thing about when you wrestle with God, you always come away limping. You can't beat God. We are allowed to wrestle with God. God actually looks forward to the fellowship. He does. You know, if you think back to your children, as you're raising your children, trying to develop your children, inevitably you're going to wind up wrestling with them over some things. And what happens is that sometimes you can kind of see them coming, you know. And you sort of look forward to the whole process of working it through with them, even though you know it's going to be a wrestle for a while. And God's not insecure, and He actually enjoys wrestling with us to a point. I mean, He'd rather we just be obedient like Jesus, but He's quite willing to go to the mat with us. Like a good father, God will limit Himself so that we can work through our issues. The whole process of us wrestling with Him is for our own benefit, so that we can work through our issues. You know, it's funny, I have one of my most precious wrestling stories about me and my father. My father and I would wrestle when we were kids, and of course he would act like I was winning, and then all of a sudden I would. But, you know, it's just how you do with your kids. And when I was like 17, I was home from seminary. I studied to be a priest in high school. And I was doing the dishes in the kitchen, which is something, you know, if I've got anything to work out, I do dishes. I love doing dishes. So I was washing dishes. You know what? We our only marital struggle has been because Nancy wants to use the dishwasher. And I want to do dishes. I like to wash with my hands. And what happens is, I've actually washed the dishes and been rebuked for it, and taken them and stuck them in the dishwasher so she can... You wrestle with your wife too, but that's a different story. At any rate, the point is, as I was doing dishes, and my father came in, he'd been working all night, and he came in and he was at the stove trying to get something to eat or something, whatever. And we got to talking and we got to joshing around. One thing led to another and we were just kind of wrestling around. I'm 17 years old. He hadn't seen me in 9 months. And we got to wrestling around, and all of a sudden, I had him bent over the stove backwards. And I could see a look in his eyes that went, oh my God. And I knew, and I thought, oh my God, I have overcome my father. And this isn't holy. I knew it was wrong. I just knew that humiliating my father was not the right thing to do. And so I kind of backed off a little bit, and I harumphed, and he harumphed. And we joshed it off, and then he went away, and I went away, and we never wrestled again. Because it is not right to embarrass your father. It's not right to do that. Sure, he's getting older, I'm getting older. He's starting to diminish, I'm in the prime of my life. But you see what I'm saying? There are rules of engagement for decency in all of this, and God has his own set of rules. And so he wrestles with us. We wrestle with our children. God's a good father. He will limit himself so that we can work through our issues. But in the end, God will always prevail. We will always become broken when we decide to wrestle with the living God. Jacob eventually realizes he's wrestling with God, not a man like Laban or Esau. We all eventually come to this point. We all have our critical encounters with God in life. And when we do, we often get a new name or reputation and a new nature, either good or bad. It's just sort of a part of the deal. After he wrestled with God and came through that, he got a new nature. His name was Israel, not Jacob any longer. And a new nature. We are seen in a new way, both either good or bad. Jacob has realized his sin, repented unto God, and sought restoration with the brother he has offended, and he's accepted God as his Lord and Savior. He is a changed man, a born-again man. Jacob is no longer the supplanter. He is now Israel, meaning Prince of God. Come daybreak, the Lord wants to depart so that Jacob will not look upon him and be destroyed. Remember, we've talked about this. You can't see God and live. They've been wrestling in the night, in the darkness. And so the daybreak is coming, and the Lord wants to depart. Similarly, God later warns Moses that sinful humans cannot look upon God and live to tell about it. Jacob, nonetheless, says, I have seen the face of God. And so he names the place Peniel, or Penuel, meaning face of God. Any encounter with God, good or bad, with the living God, will change us at the core. It'll change us. We come to know God better, ourselves better, and have more spiritual discernment, or we refuse to be broken by it and are destroyed. All salvation is based in relationship. What God wants is relationship. We were created for relationship with God. We were built in communities of relationship. Husband, wife, father, children, mom, dad. We were created in families because those are the havens of relationship. What God wants is relationship, not religion, not ritual, relationship. And in that relationship, there is a conversation. And that conversation can go everywhere from sweet nothings of love to anger and railing, yelling, and hollering, screaming, all the things that you find in relationship. And God is a father, and he works through all those things with us. We need to learn to live in daily, moment-by-moment relationship with God. And some of those relationships are going to be wrestling matches. They're going to be wrestling matches. And when push came to shove, Jacob was a man who had a lot of relationship with God. Some of it good and some of it not. He had a lot of trips to the woodshed. And then he had other times when God was with him and helped him through things. And what that created in Jacob was discernment. He knew God. He knew the things of God. He knew how God thought. He had discernment. He understood right from wrong. He understood the things of God. And he taught them to Joseph. Wished he had taught them to his other sons. Isaac, for instance, never had much relationship with God. He was a rich man's son. He didn't interface with God much. He had little or no sin. Wasn't like God had to deal with him there. Everything was sort of provided for him, including his wife. He never dealt with God much, and therefore he lacked discernment. He couldn't discern the right son. And Jacob, as you will see later, winds up discerning the right grandson between two sons he's never met in his life. And he knows which one is supposed to rule the other one. So our processes of being with God and wrestling with God are good. They're intentional, and they will either build us or break us. And sometimes when they break us, it's a good thing, because we're like wild horses, you know, we're wild ponies. But God desires that kind of relationship. Comments on this before I go on.
I have a question. It's about Esau and Jacob, but not this particularly. You know, when Jacob birthright, when he swapped the suit, that was his birthright. So that was physical, correct? That was land?
Yeah, birthright's birthright.
Okay, so that's the land.
Yeah.
Then when he tricked him with the blessing, is that what would have made him kinsman redeemer?
Yeah. He tricked his father into giving him the blessing of the kinsman redeemer.
Okay.
He tricked Esau into giving him his spiritual blessing, which is tied to his physical blessing. Esau didn't believe in spiritual blessing, so he was kind of like, sure, whatever you say. Because he was not a spiritual man. But, you know, Jacob was going to wind up with the head of the family. Esau said that, you know, church stuff doesn't count. Okay, anything else?
And even though Isaac was weak, he was still a kinsman redeemer.
Every kinsman redeemer except for Jesus has been by definition flawed. Everybody God deals with is flawed. David said, blessed is he who God does not hold his sin against him, who does not count his iniquity. We're all flawed. It's not whether we're sinful or not sinful that separates us from God. It's whether or not we will accept or receive a relationship with him. We're all flawed. We're all weak. We're all bent, corrupt, somewhere or the other, sometimes more so than others. Okay? I mean, you know, he sends Nebuchadnezzar as his tool. He sends Sennacherib as his tool. You won't find worse men in the world. Saddam Hussein's choir boy compared to these people. I could prove it, but it'd make you nauseated. We have our will. We have those things we want. We're quite capable of saying, you know, I will have this. I will have this. I will have this. I'm going to have this. And, you know, I'll do my own thing, whatever. I will not accept not having this. We're all capable of that. Some of us do that about some things. Some of us do that about everything. But we're all capable of that. And sooner or later, our will has to break against God's will. And we need to accept God's will. And that process very often requires a wrestling. Okay. Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, Leah her children next, and Joseph and Rachel last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. So he took the children, and the children of the maids were here, and the children of Leah were here, and the children of Rachel were back at the back, and he himself went in front of all of them, and he bowed, prostrated himself before Esau, as Esau was coming 7 times before he got to Esau. Now, the placement of those children is an important issue. We'll get to it later. So he passed on ahead of them, bowed to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children, and he said, who are these with you? And he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. And the maids came near with their children, they bowed down. And Leah came near likewise. Their children, they bowed down. And afterwards, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? What do you mean by all of these droves of animals and these people that you sent? What do you mean by that? What's this all about? And he said to him, I meant to find favor in the sight of my Lord. I, Jacob, meant to find favor in your sight, my Lord, Esau. And Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own. I don't need your stuff. And Jacob said, no, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. I am as glad to see your face as I am to see God. That you're that valuable to me. So please receive me favorably. Take my gifts. Please take my gift which I have brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty. Then he urged him and he took it. Esau accepted it. Esau said, well, let us take our journey and go, and I will go before you. But he, Jacob, said to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail, the flocks and the herds which are nursing are a care to me. If they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure, according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. And Esau said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. Leave you some guards, protection. He said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore he called the name of the place Succoth. After 20 years, Jacob finally faces Esau and his own sins. He divides his family for safety, but in a very telltale manner. He shows an obvious preference for Rachel and Joseph. This obvious favoritism comes back to haunt him tragically. It's like, well, Bilhah and the maid's kids, they'll get killed first. Then Leah and her kids will get killed. And then maybe I'll be able to save Joseph and Rachel. Jacob passes on before them to Esau and bows down to them in obvious and abject humility. He shows the deference he was trying to avoid with his original deceptions 20 years early. I mean, 20 years ago, he could have gotten by for a whole lot less than this. Esau's response is not what Jacob expected. Esau's glad to see him and has long since forgiven him. You know, the thing about this that's good is this whole experience has taught something to Jacob that he would not have known otherwise. All that he's been through for 20 years, all of this wrestling, all that has brought him to a place of humility that he would have never had before Esau if all of this hadn't happened. That doesn't mean God wanted it to happen. It means God can God can redeem anything. God can make lemonade out of lemons. And he has a really interesting recipe for chicken salad. God can redeem and will redeem anything. All the struggles in our life, all the mistakes that we make, all of the sins we commit, all of that, God will work that to our good if we love him or are called according to his purpose. Romans 8:28, for God works all things to our good for those that love the Lord, called according to purpose. Whatever our mistakes are in the past, God can use those. They become fodder, grist in our mill. All the successes we have, he can use those too. All the struggles we had, he can use those. Because he can make something out of them. Esau, in fact, has the birthright that Jacob tried in vain to steal. For 20 years, Esau has been the kinsman redeemer in his family. He grew up, all that his father has is his. All that Isaac had belongs to Esau. He is the ruler of the family. He is the kinsman redeemer. Esau does not want to rule over Jacob, nor to take ownership of his goods. He has no interest in being Jacob's ruler. He generously offers Jacob a place in the land with freedom from fealty. Just come and dwell among us as a brother. He's not asking him to submit to him. He gladly offers Jacob protective custody and open-handed friendship. Jacob fully honors Esau, calling him the face of God. Addresses him as Lord, but Jacob wisely determines not to live among Esau and his people or among his gods. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Familiarity breeds contempt. Jacob knows that if they get together and live together again, too much opportunity for difficulty there. And so he manages to live away from him. Esau's people, his gods and his ways would only corrupt Jacob. Jacob journeys to Succoth and builds a house there. He remains there for 6 years, according to the age of Dinah, in the next chapter. This gives him time to reestablish relationships with Dad and Esau. Rebekah had died during the 20 years that they were gone. The next 6 years are peaceful, uneventful family-raising years. This is a period of peace in Jacob's life heretofore he's not had and will never have again. Never have again. This is a kind of a holy place here. Comments before I go on.
Is the bowing down seven times just completes
submission?
It's an honorific, yeah. It's a cultural honorific. Sometimes in movies you see people do like this. Mm-hmm. Okay. That constitutes a bow, but this was a prone on your face bow. Other comments? You know, I love Genesis because it tells us these stories, and these stories have very important meanings to us in our lives. And if we read them just as kind of like stories, I mean, you know, you can make movies out of them, people have. And they're interesting just from a narrative point of view. As a literary narrative, they're interesting. But they're loaded with very important information for us. Why does God wrestle all night with Jacob? Why does he take all night when he could whip him in 7 seconds? You know, why does he do that? Why does he limit himself to the point where Jacob can actually struggle with him all night and all but prevail? Why does he do that? Why does he let us take him on like that? So I said something?
I said, it's got to be for us to learn.
Well, it's for our sake. Yeah. It's for our sake. If God was one of these, I want to dominate you, I want to kick your butt, I want to, you know, I'm just angry and mad and bitter and whatever, he wouldn't do all this. He wouldn't go to this kind of trouble. This is the behavior of a loving father, this Old Testament God that everybody's always talking about. This is the behavior of a loving father. We're getting 50 chapters of this stuff. Sometimes we see God the disciplinarian, sometimes we see God as the proud father, and sometimes we see God as a guy just trying to raise his family and they're a mess.
You look back at Abraham, he and his family, that he was kinsman redeemer of, lived often separate, whereas Lot went and lived with the corrupt people nearby. And here, now that he is right with God, he's taking his people off the side to keep them pure.
Come you out and be you separate. Come you out and be your separate. And yeah, that's and we're meant to live that way. We're meant to live separately. Even though we're in the community, we're meant to live separately. We're meant to have our own set of values, our own understandings, our own God, our own relationship with God. We're supposed to surround ourselves with like-minded people. That's what a church is. Among other things, it's a haven for like-minded people to come together to be able to live the culture of the kingdom of heaven. Now, it's more than that. It's also a way to reach out to the world in many, many different ways, caring for our neighbor and witnessing to who God is and all that sort of thing. When Nancy and I met the Lord, we met the Lord in a church where the brotherhood of the believers was a very heavy reality. We all knew one another very, very well. We all knew each other's kids. We were all deeply involved in each other's lives. I'll give you an example. I used to pastor 12 men. Albrecht, Brewer, Breitenstein, Klemmer, Lindenberger, O'Neill, Schugert, and Starnes. These were people who were by direct. I pastored them directly, and they all had people they pastored directly, as it were. It was a kind of a like that. And when we would, like on Wednesday nights, I'd have a meeting with my people, and then Monday nights they'd have a meeting with their people. So I had 150, 200 people that were I was pastoring directly or indirectly, and we knew everything that was going on in the hearts of all these people because we dwelt and lived together in that way. Now, we were all poor. There was none among us who were wealthy, there was a couple, but they stood out like a sore thumb, and they didn't act like they were wealthy. But most of us were blue-collar, working-collar, working-class people. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but we had a lot of skills. So one of the things that we would do is we would take weekends and we would go to each other's houses and upgrade each other's houses, you know, with the skills that we had. And so, like, guys, if we're doing concrete, the guys with concrete skills would lead the crew. If you're doing wallpapering, they would lead the crew. If you're doing carpentry, they would lead the electrician. They lead the crew, plumbing. And among us, we had all these skills. And so we were able to go and help each other constantly. Every year we had an event where we took all the people to the YMCA of the Rockies. All the people in our church who could possibly get vacation would go because they wanted to. And then we would meet other churches who would also come together with their people in the same manner. And so we'd have thousands of people at the YMCA of the Rockies. And we would spend the day having a lot of fun with our kids and family, riding the raft down the Snake River and going over the Mary Jane ski lift and doing all kinds of fun things. And at night we would have our meetings. We'd get together after supper, and we would worship for an hour and a half, and they'd preach for an hour and a half, and then they'd start healing people and all that kind of stuff, and it would go up into the night. It was a very wonderful time. And we did that for a week every year. Some people could afford that. Some people couldn't. So what we did was, is we worked on the weekends some often to make money using these skills so that we would have money so that those people who couldn't afford could go. And some people had vehicles that would get them there and some didn't. And so we would help people arrange transportation. Sometimes we'd go out and rent stuff. We actually rented buses from Manhattan, Kansas to get us over to Colorado. But we organized this so that the whole family could go if they wanted to. And everybody who could would go get their vacation, whatever. And we were deeply involved in each other's lives on a voluntary basis. And we cared for one another. And because of that, we grew like crazy. Because people looked and they said, you know, y'all really love one another. And they came, and you know, we were Pentecostal, we spoke in tongues and all that sort of thing. So, but even people who were not into that, all of that, they came to see us and to see what we were about and what we did. And some people called us a cult because we were more involved in each other's lives. But that's going to happen. They called Jesus the same thing. We care for one another, love one another, help one another, and bore each other's burdens. And nobody's child died that we didn't all feel it. And nobody's dog died and we didn't all feel it. Nobody went hungry. Nobody had a need. We didn't all feel it. And it was a family, extraordinary family of people. That's what a church is supposed to be. That's what a church is supposed to be. And too often what church is something different than that. Now, if you look at our church, one of the things you see is people gather together in small groups. Like there's the cooking team. All the people in the small group, they know each other. They know what's going on. Classrooms. We got people in this class. We kind of know each other. And you tend to get together in small groups because it's hard for 1,200, 1,300 people to do that. And so that's what we did. That's what a church is supposed to be about. So that people, we demonstrate the love of God in the way we lived. You know, Antioch, they began to call them Christians because they were obvious followers of Christ. That's where they first started calling them Christians. And they said, see how they love one another. See how they love one another. And we're told, for instance, in about the third chapter book of Acts, that when the people were in need, that everybody who had excess brought it to the elders and gave it to them, and no one was lacking anything. Now they fed the widows and the orphans and took care of all of them because people took their excess and brought it for distribution for that purpose. So there's a whole process of living together as a people that we're meant to have, or meant to be a part of our walk with the Lord. That's what church is supposed to be. Comments before we leave?
It seems to me that especially in this area of the country that we live in, it's very hard for us to define what excess is, because we see so differently than people that are in real need.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
See, and I think the only way we can cure that is to ask God to show us what is needed versus what is wanted.
Well, one of the things about walking in relationship with the Lord is He will show us that. Mm-hmm. And no one can show us that but God. No one can show us that but God. One of the things that was really cool about the way it worked among us is that it was all very voluntary and very joyful. You know, no one said, you know, gosh, you've got this, you should give that away or whatever. That would be out of bounds. People would come and they would donate stuff and they were joyful to do it, glad to do it. If we had a need, we just put out there was a need, and we'd be inundated with, you know, what was meant for that. And that's how it's meant to be. And it's that kind, those kinds of churches. If you think about the small churches of our parents, that's the way they lived. I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and the small Catholic communities were just like that. I remember in where I came from in Owensboro, the first thing you did when you wanted to build a church is you built the barbecue pit. Because every weekend, every church had their annual barbecue. And in Owensboro, you barbecued mutton more than anything else. So you built the pit, big, nice, long, concrete thing, tables out like this, got a roof over the head, you know, we got a shingle roof, corner post and whatever. And then you started making the money to build the sanctuary, which you built out of the cash at hand. And, you know, then you built a parsonage for the priests and all, whatever. And these churches were communities, and they all, you know, there was a group called the Maple Mount, which is where my parents came from. St. Joseph's, the church, and my grandparents. And they all knew each other intimately. They knew what was going on. They knew who needed prayer. They just did. And they knew who was in rebellion. They knew who was walking away. They prayed for them. They knew who the prodigals were. And they helped each other. And they lived that way. And we did that as a culture, as a people. We did that. In the main, all the way back to the time we got here. Back to the Mayflower Compact. And sometimes some better than others. But in the main, that's how we as a culture lived. Until World War II, until after the war. And then we became a culture of selfishness. A culture of selfishness. And it wasn't like it was always perfect, because it wasn't. There was revival four times in this country. And it wasn't like when it was good that everybody was good. It wasn't like that. But there was enough leaven in the loaf for it to be seen. So that's what we're asking God for again. Somebody pray us out, please.